Welcome back to Vincere, the Story of Italian 90 podcast. Mark here again to guide you through June 15th, 1990 in Italy and plenty more besides throughout the show. I'll be joined later by author of the brilliant All Played Out, Pete Davies, and writer, academic and broadcaster David Goldblatt to debate whether Italian 90 could be described as the first modern World Cup. But first, we're going to look at the day's games. The tea time kickoff was the Group A clash between Austria and Czechoslovakia in Florence, and things are starting to get real, as they say, with this second round of group games seeing teams eliminated. We already lost the USSR, and defeat here for the Austrians would see them and the USA go too, even after their plucky but ultimately losing display against Italy yesterday. So, do or die for the Austrians, while Czechoslovakia, who were pretty impressive against the USA, would have their credentials more seriously tested here. The game reflected the situation both countries found themselves in. Scottish referee George Smith handed out 7 yellow cards during the contest, an indicator of just how committed both sides were to taking something out of it. The decisive moment came around the half-hour mark, when Czechoslovakian midfielder Josef Chovanec intercepted a careless back pass by Anton Pfeffer. Austrian goalkeeper Klaus Lindenberger rushed out to snuff out the danger, but only proceeded to upend Chovanec to concede a needless penalty. Michal Bielek, who had both scored from the spot and fluffed a Panenka-style second in the 5-1 win over the Americans, decided to drill it low and hard to secure his nation's safe passage to the knockout round with a game to spare. For Josef Venglos' squad, well, they looked to be a team worth avoiding as the tournament progressed, but for Austria, it was Auf Wiedersehen. And so to another team on the brink of elimination, the United Arab Emirates, who were always going to have it tough at Italia 90, and then they were drawn in a group consisting of West Germany, Yugoslavia and Colombia. Far from disgraced in their opening game against the Colombians, they were now faced with the seemingly insurmountable task, West Germany in the San Siro, which was packed with tens of thousands of German fans. Just a few days earlier, West Germany had looked imperious against Yugoslavia, and it was certainly conceivable that the UAE were in line for a record-breaking margin of defeat in a World Cup game. That looked all the more likely when, and surprisingly only by today's accepted standards, Franz Beckenbauer, the German coach, opted to go with an unchanged starting 11 from their opening match, when he could have reasonably been expected to give some of his stand-ins some valuable game time. Perhaps he was wary of the Cameroon or Costa Rica effect, inspiring the UAE towards a shock. He needn't have worried. There's really only one word to summarise this 90 minutes. Siege. Amazingly, it still took 35 minutes for West Germany to score their first goal. A plethora of good chances were squandered as they camped in the UAE's half before going a goal ahead. Voller and Klinsmann were particularly wasteful. Voller's first goal was a neat little finish under pressure from a Klinsmann cross. The second came just 2 minutes later from Klinsmann himself. A Stefan Reuter cross from the right found him about 10 yards out, and he leapt high and unchallenged to bury a trademark header into the bottom corner. Floodgates open and nerves settled. Incredibly, it was the UAE who scored immediately after half-time, when a simple long ball up the middle caught the West Germany defence in some kind of trance, as they seemed to lose all bearings. Tiny Thomas Hessler, coming round on the cover, was beaten by the bounce of the ball, allowing Khalid Ismail to make history as his nation's first goalscorer at the World Cup. He held his nerve well to hit a crisp low finish into the bottom corner past Bodo Ilgner. Normal service was resumed just a minute later, however, when Lothar Matthäus added to his goal tally with a volley from the edge of the area. Uwe Bein hit a 20-yarder into the top of the net on 58 minutes for 4-1, and the scoring was completed by Voller on 75 minutes. The UAE were extremely fortunate to escape without having double figures rattle up against them. It really was that one-sided. If anything, West Germany were sloppy rather than their ruthless selves. Obviously, they have plenty more stories to furnish us with as the competition progresses, so let's give the UAE some of the limelight while we have the chance. To trace their journey through Italia 90, I spoke with Ali Khaled, director of the documentary film The Lights of Rome, all about the UAE and the 1990 World Cup. Ali, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
The UAE's time at Italia 90 was expectedly brief, and the draw was certainly unkind when they got there. But let's go further back a bit and to their journey to the finals, and especially the final phase that took place in Singapore. Explain to us how arduous it was for that squad to go through that part of the qualification.
Yeah, no one really gave the UAE any hope of qualifying in Singapore. They it was a pretty tough group. South Korea were quite strong, and in many ways, I think the UAE were probably the least fancied of all the teams. 4 years earlier, they had come very close to reaching sort of the final stage before qualifying for Mexico, and they had a pretty strong team, and they fell at the last hurdle against Iraq. They conceded the last minute goal, and it was pretty devastating for them. But 4 years on, no one really expected them to do much, and they were quite unprepared. The president of the Football Association had quit, just before that period in Singapore. And they lacked leadership. The team wasn't very strong. The preparation wasn't great. They weren't playing well. And so when they got to Singapore, some of the players themselves were saying, we went, just because, to fulfill our commitments, really. No one was thinking beyond that at the time. Obviously, when they got there, the expectations were really low. And they drew their first match and barely made a splash in the media here, it was not like front page, certainly not front page news, but even in the sports pages, it was just like the UAE national team has drawn the first match, nothing was expected. And I think in many ways, the second game was the one that turned everything around for them. It was against China, and they were losing 1-0. It was pretty dire conditions. It was played in the rain and on a muddy pitch. Stadium was practically empty, not many people like bothered to show up there, even from the locals. And it went into the 89th minute and they were 1-0 down. Nobody really expected much. And I think, had they lost that one, I think all hope would have just evaporated right there and then. But what ended up happening was a minor miracle. They scored an equalizer, headed equalizer, in the 90th minute, and almost in the next minute. The UAE's greatest ever player, Adnan Al-Talyani, scored the winner. And so, those two goals in injury time turned it round, and suddenly, there was hope where obviously there had been none before. And it kind of transmitted itself back here. Suddenly people took notice and thought, it could be something happening here. I think to this day, it's probably the most dramatic game the UAE have ever played, possibly the best, it just completely changed the tone of their stay in Singapore. Mind you, the next two games against Saudi and Qatar both finished in draws, so in a way, they didn't push on and really play much better. They drew their first, so at that point they had three draws and a win, but the way the games went in the group meant that their final game against South Korea, who by that point had qualified, had taken the first spot. It meant that the UAE's fate depended on other matches, and they ended up drawing with South Korea. South Korea took an early lead, and the UAE equalized in the first half, finished 1-1. But all the drama happened between China and Qatar. And China had been leading Qatar almost in a replay of what happened against the UAE. They conceded two late goals, and those two late goals are what allowed the UAE to qualify, really. So when news broke to the UAE players in against South Korea, it was at the final whistle. When the final whistle went, they didn't really know what was happening in the other match, but news came through that Qatar had scored a dramatic late equalizer, and that's how the UAE qualified, and obviously there was massive celebration.
So it sounds like the key to qualification seemed to be that difficulty to beat. Was this a circumstance of the players that were available at the time, or the quality of coaching and tactics from the experienced coach and the Brazilian Carlos Alberto Pereira, or was it the perfect combination of the two?
I think, the players at the time were amateurs. That was one of the things, of course. I think if you go back a little bit back, the UAE as a nation did not exist until late 1971. Every single player in that squad, one of the great things about that story is every single player in that squad was born before the UAE was actually, an independent country, So, in many ways, looking back, football was still, the Football Association was set up in 1972. You're talking about 17-year association. Football was still in its infancy in a way. obviously Don Revy had been brought in 1977 to like sort of bring some professionalism to the game here, and while like his day obviously in terms of results was not is not looked back upon very fondly, he did try and introduce like a level of professionalism, a level of fitness that was not there at the time, and it was tough, physically. I mean, he came from Leeds, where he had one of the toughest teams of all time, and he came here, and the players physically were not up to the standards that he was used to, of course, and the game had to grow up like pretty quickly, and Don Revy left in '79, so it was like 10 years beyond that. He had sort of set in motion, the professionalism that 10 years later got them to the World Cup. But they were still, it was still an amateur game. A lot of them were like, policemen and firemen and, worked in civil services and which they went back to, at the end of their careers. So I think there was, the standards were lower for the players compared to other Asian countries. And obviously the game was still not that advanced. There was a league, of course, but looking back, it was not such a high standard.
Your documentary about the UAE's road to Italia 90 is called Anwar Roma, or The Lights of Rome. Can you explain where that title comes from, and also tell us about the making of the film?
So 9 years ago, just before the World Cup in South Africa, I was working in a newspaper here in the UAE and in Abu Dhabi, and I wanted to write a story about the 20th anniversary of the UAE qualifying to the World Cup, and I just found that it had become almost like a slightly forgotten story. Certainly the qualification, people remembered the matches in Italy, but not many people remember the qualifications, which to me is really sort of the miracle here, the big story. So I started asking around, and people, people had vague memories of it. Some remembered the China game, some remembered the last match against South Korea, but one of the things that kept coming up over and over was that everyone saying, we remember the commentator. They said, he started crying at the end of the match, and it's a big part of the film, so I reckon it's the heart of the documentary. So when he was commentating on, his name is Adnan Hamad, he's like a very famous commentator here. He was commenting on the last match, it was 1-1, and someone just stuck their head in and said, Qatar has scored. So, as soon as, he heard that, he started crying, and, the whistle had just gone, and the players, they got the news, they all started celebrating. And then he started, as he was crying, he started saying, I can see the lights of Rome from here, I can see the lights of Rome, which is in Arabic is Anwar Roma. So it was, and a lot of people remembered that, maybe not the words, but they remembered the final whistle and the commentator crying, and he made a name for himself on the back of this. I suppose it's the equivalent of, there's some people on the pitch, or the German commentator in 1954. It's that sort of memorable here. So people remembered that a lot more than the actual football and the results. So it made sense to sort of like base it around that.
The team suffered a couple of heavy defeats when they got to the finals, and in the game we featured today against West Germany, the 5-1 scoreline was probably a bit flattering to the UAE. They'd had their backs to the walls throughout, and on another day the Germans could have got double figures. Did these heavy defeats sour the World Cup experience, either for the players or the supporters who went to Italy or those back home, or did they retain an enormous sense of pride at just being at the tournament in the first place?
I think they certainly retained a sense of pride. They came back, and when they came back from qualifications, they were treated. They had a presidential meeting and so on, and they were treated like heroes anyway. But I think they went to the World Cup. It was a tough group, with West Germany, Yugoslavia, and Colombia. Couldn't possibly have been any tougher for the UAE. Three incredible teams, and I think despite the heavy defeats. The first one against Colombia was 2-0, but like obviously the second one against Germany was quite heavy. I think they're quite proud that they got there, that they put the UAE on the map. Not many people had heard of the country, never mind the team. There's some interesting stories that came out as well, like in the film. They said before that match against Germany, they'd come out to warm up, and then the heavens opened and started raining really heavily, and there was thunder. And like all the German players like ran off the pitch, and you know all the UAE players were confused, like what was happening, and they came back in with their you know fancy Adidas shoes, you know, with their metal studs, and they said we didn't have any metal studs, you know, we were just wearing our boots that we always wore, which were like the molded ones, and so they were like slipping all over the place, and so I mean that's even though you know money was available and you know they were not like a poor team, it just showed like a sort of lack of preparation or you know foresight really. So I mean they still kind of looked on heroically. The goalkeeper that day, Mohsen Sabah, you know, they I mean they helped Germany for 36 minutes, I think it was 0-0, and then Germany scored twice, so it was 2-0 at half time, and then obviously in the second half they really battered them, but they did they pulled it back to 2-1 through a player called Khaled Ismail, and you know, he became a hero just on the back of that goal. Everyone, you know, like, still talks to him. Like he says, like whenever anyone talks to him, you know, about football these days, they still bring up that goal. So I don't think it was like a shameful performance. If anything, you know, they appreciated, you know, the effort. And like I said earlier, the real miracle was in qualifying. Anything after that was a bonus. Yeah. I know a lot of teams say that these days. It's a bit of a cliche that you know you're just reaching it. It's fantastic. But in you know at the time, the UAE was probably the smallest country to ever make it, or one of the smallest countries to ever make it. So yeah, they definitely returned a certain pride, especially the two players who scored. You know, those two goals are constantly mentioned. It's like a high point for football.
Well, speaking of those two scorers, despite those three group stage defeats, there is of course that famous and uplifting story, oft repeated but perhaps a myth. You know, you hear conflicting reports that any player who scored in the finals in Italy would be given a Rolls Royce as a reward by the country's ruler at the time, Sheikh Zayed. Was that true? And if so, did either of the two scorers, Khaled Ismail and Ali Thani, did they ever receive their Rolls Royce?
I think it is one of those myth stories, as you mentioned. No question, the players were treated very well when they came back, and they were, you know, like showered with gifts and all that. I don't think that they received their Rolls Royces, though.
It's a shame, that, isn't it? And finally, what happened next for UAE football and that team once the Italian 90 fairy tale was over?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was a missed opportunity, really. I mean, in many ways, I think in terms of the team itself, you know, that was they called the golden generation. Although obviously it was still a limited team, you know, in many ways, it was a great achievement. But it's like the game did not push on from that, you know, from sort of that high point. After Carlos Alberto Pereira left, they hired Lobanevsky, the Ukrainian coach, who was one of the greats. But they failed to qualify to the 94 World Cup. And, you know, at that point, sort of the Golden Generation team was, a lot of them had retired, a lot of them were close to the end. And I guess there was a last hurrah in 1996. The AFC Asian Cup was held in the Emirates, and they did make it to the final, but lost on penalties to Saudi. So I guess that's like sort of the closest they've been to winning an international trophy, a continental trophy. So, but I think also, you know, in the wider picture, like it was almost like a sense of missed opportunity. That you know, it got so much attention, worldwide attention, but like attention here, and there was like people fell in love with the national team again, all that. And then that kind of faded. You know, they did not push on. The results weren't there, and people became, for a while at least, you know, apathetic towards the national team. In '96, when they got to the final here, again interest was raised because it was held at home, and you know, after you know the quarterfinal and the semifinal, people would go out and celebrate in the streets. But we're almost 30 years on, and that's still seen sort of as like, sort of a high point, you know, in terms of the World Cup, of course. There has been a few high points since then, you know, for the national team, but more like regionally. They won the Gulf Cup in 2007, and then again in 2013. I mean, this is regionally, it's a bit of bragging rights against the six Gulf countries, but, you know, obviously, I'm sure they give that up for another World Cup qualifications, and hopes were high for the 2016 qualification. The national team had reached the semi-finals of the Asian Cup in Australia in 2015, and it was a very good team, and they were starting to be called the second golden generation. So, they're called Omar Abdulrahman, who's a great player, and you know, someone who was a lot of interest in him, like from European teams, and you know, a really, really skillful player, someone who could have, you know, could have played in Europe, but decided against it. He was sort of the focal point of the team, and there was really good hope that they could reach 2016. They even kicked off with a win in Japan, which was incredible, really. But you know, the team sort of hit a plateau. They never improved after 2015. So sadly, that was sort of the height, was the semi-final of the Asian Cup 2015. So you know, it doesn't look like they'll be reaching the World Cup anytime soon. You know, it's still early days in the present qualifying campaign, but the team is not really at the standard where it can reach the World Cup. And possibly when, you know, it becomes a 48-team World Cup, I think that there may be a few more spots open, and you know, the UAE, which always seems to be there or thereabouts, but never making it qualify again. But 1990 is sort of it's a long time ago, and everyone still looks back as like the golden era, which is a shame. You know, the game has come on a lot, and you know, there's a lot better stadiums, a lot more funding. You know, there's a lot of professional players now. You know, players from abroad, but you know, the national team just continues to struggle.
I'm delighted to say Pete Davis is with me again. How are you, Pete?
Hi, Mark. Very well, thank you.
Good. Ready to open the memory banks again, I hope.
Yes, indeed.
And it's a privilege for me to introduce David Goldblatt. Thanks for being on the show, David. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. So, just a quick mention for the standout performance of the two games at Italia 90 on this day. We heard from Ali earlier about the United Arab Emirates in today's showpiece game. And West Germany, they did the minimum in that game, and they were such a daunting prospect, weren't they? They were well-balanced, well-rounded, powerful, stylish, organised, and they also managed to top it off by peaking perfectly for 1990, didn't they?
They really did, yes. If you remember the scene from the end of Saving Private Ryan, where they're waiting for the panzer tanks and they hear them before they see them, that's what being in Italy, knowing that the Germans were there, was like. There was this thunder in the distance of this absolutely astonishing team that you knew was coming your way. And it was thrilling. For me, I was very fortunate in that they were in the other half of the draw from the story that I was following with England, and I didn't see live any of their earlier games. I did, of course, see quite a lot of it on the television, but it meant that there was this presence in the tournament that you just knew if anybody strikes you as who's going to be the champions, it's that team. Everything you saw, everything you heard about Mateus, Klinsmann, Brahma, you just thought they looked perfect, and the historical context was so extraordinary that you knew it was the last time that West Germany were playing as West Germany. There was something very special about that squad.
So, to our main theme now, and the question for you both, was Italia 90 the first modern World Cup? Or was it, as some of our followers on Twitter have argued, the last old-school World Cup, and that USA 94 was actually the real dawning of a new era? It probably depends on the criteria to define this debate. If we start with branding and commercialization of Italia 90, okay, previous World Cups had their huge multinational corporate sponsors, official mascots, merchandising, and so on. But it felt, to me at least, that way in advance of the tournament, that Chow the stick man was everywhere, and there wasn't much you couldn't buy that didn't have him on it, and there were, of course, all the other brands that were associated with the World Cup were also plastering everything Italia 90 on them, and no doubt the sums of money being poured into this particular competition to have the brands associated with it had risen sharply compared to any previous tournaments that had gone on.
My feeling is that it's very definitely the last of the old school, old world World Cups. There was plenty of evidence, as you've just described, of the direction of travel for FIFA, that they had their eyes firmly on making this vast enterprise as hugely profitable as they possibly could. But it was still possible in 1990 to identify with players and teams in a way that today I personally, and this may be a generational thing, but I personally cannot identify with someone who's making £250,000 a week. It wasn't that way then. Yes, they were well paid, but it was still, there was still a bond. You could still be purist about it. And the vast amount of commercial stuff that was beginning to come in was like a hindrance, and you could sort of push it to one side. You could admire and appreciate some of the panache of it, but it wasn't the core enterprise. The football still was the core enterprise in a way that it's difficult not to be cynical about today.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in what Pete says. I think I kind of see it. It's got a foot in both camps. You know, there are hints of the new as well that are to come. I mean, it's interesting. It's the last really, you know, pretty much analog World Cup. You know, no internet, no social media, no digital yet. The beginnings of pay-per-view television. But not yet fully engulfing football. I mean, the Premier League is 2 years hence. The Champions League, you know, the remodeled European Cup, which sort of redefines the televisual spectacular in football, is 2 years away. So we're getting elements of that, though, because the television, certainly in Britain, you know, just as a punter at home, I had a sense at the time that it was being shown at a different level. And maybe again that's nostalgia, but there was something about having you know, Des Lynam had a fantastic World Cup, and the Pavarotti that they sing Nessun Dorma, you know, appending opera to the World Cup was a new move. You could feel some sort of change in the air around that.
I think you're absolutely spot on there, David. I think the last analog World Cup is an exceptionally good way of putting it. I've been thinking about this, knowing we were going to be talking about this. I've have a sort of sense that there are three ages of football. And the first one, the mythic one, back from the dawn of time, obviously is in black and white, and the crowds are enormous, and they're entirely male, and everybody's wearing a cloth cap. And the player goes to the ground on the same bus as the fans and makes, if he's lucky, £12 a week, £8 a week in the summer. And the second age of football comes along in the early 60s when Jimmy Hill and the rest break the earnings cap and players start getting paid commensurate with their talent and their drawing power. And the game goes into colour and George Best becomes football's first pop star. And at that time, you could say that the last of the original world of football peaked for the English in 66. But thereafter, the World Cup was a larger, more serious thing that was growing in colour and excitement and romance. And you anticipated Brazil so much. I remember being 11 for the 1970 World Cup, and Brazil was just something absolutely magical that you didn't know about but you yearned to see, because of course you never saw hardly any football on television, and you certainly didn't see Brazilians on television. So, you know, and they didn't play in Europe. So there was still romance, and that was still there in 1990. And obviously the World Cup that you go to is always going to be your World Cup, you know, and I'm going to have a massive bias towards Italia 90 because I had one of the great experiences of my lifetime going to that tournament. But it still had a purism about what football could aspire to be around it, and it wasn't buried under a wash, a deluge of marketing to the extent that it is now. And I think the jump from 1990 to 1994, that's the tipping point into
football in its third age, the modern age, where it's much, much more about commerce and celebrity and spectacle. And that operates across every aspect of it, down to the rules. You know, FIFA were determined that after 1990 that the game should be more entertaining. So they do away with the back pass rule, a very good thing too. They start looking at rule changes that will protect forward players more, and a good thing too. They look to create something that is more of a spectacle, but at that time, from 1990 going through to 94, the objective entirely was about conquering new territory, making football something that would succeed in the United States, because they were desperately nervous. Everything in Italy was focused 4 years forward from their point of view, and they were desperate in Italy to ensure that USA 94 would be a success, and they were extremely concerned that it wouldn't be. And that that's a very interesting perspective. Knowing now that that tournament was hugely successful, it didn't look like it might be in 1990. They'd gone all out to ensure that the American team had a berth to play in Italy by the convenient business of Mexico being disqualified, therefore opening the door a little bit to make it easier for the Americans to get there. But when they did get there, hardly anybody in the States watched. Virtually, I was in the States a lot at that time, and it was virtually impossible to find football on the television in the States. You know, if you were lucky, you might find some scratchy Hispanic channel that could give you some, but in English, no, no. So I think that's the tipping point, that 1990 had a lot of wonderful things about it that you could still identify with going back through the traditions and the romance of football. From FIFA's point of view, looking forward, they were about, where can we take this game until we rule the world? Which, of course, they do.
Yeah, it's an era of much more limited globalization, isn't it? I mean, when you've got three, I always, you know, recall the three Germans who are playing in Serie A, and then you got the three Dutch guys playing at Milan, and it was like, wow, three foreign players in a team. That seems unbelievably cosmopolitan. And today, a rarity. In any of the top leagues in Europe. I think there's also something, you know, it's got rougher edges, Italia 90. I mean, it's worth remembering in 1986, you know, in the final, after the trophies are handed out, you know, there's a sort of 4,000 or 5,000 person pitch invasion. You know, of kind of a mixture of like Argentinian Barra Bravas, and I mean, who knows, just sort of like going mad on the pitch and carrying Maradona aloft. And, you know, it would be inconceivable today that such a thing should happen. And Italia 90 was, yeah, they definitely tightened up a little bit on that. But, you know, the crowds and the security, all much looser and much less corporate, much less polished. You know, despite how fabulous some of the stadiums looked, actually sort of on the ground, you know, and it's an era before cheap budget airlines. It was much more sort of complicated business. No smartphones. I think that's an interesting, you know, feature of it, how people had to get around and kind of deal with it. Well, Pete, you'll know, life before a mobile phone covering a tournament. It's an interesting...
Oh, good Lord, yes.
What an interesting...
Absolutely.
All different.
You know, what I remember most about telecoms in 1990 was like being absolutely dependent on fax machines.
Yeah.
Okay. Which, you know, to get press passes and to get ticketing and to get accreditation. And, you know, 50% of the time they didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and the way that we live now, we naturally have a sort of forgetfulness, and we assume that this is always the way that it's been, when, of course, actually 30 years ago, as far as telecoms is concerned, it's the Stone Age.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can look back to that time, and my first novel was written on a Remington portable typewriter.
Well, I was going to say, one of the kind of sponsors was Olivetti. And there would have been a lot of electric typewriters, you know, but like screens, forget it. And that was absolutely sort of cutting edge of the moment, you know, that kind of office equipment. I think another, I mean, one of my, you know, favorite memories of it, I think sort of points to some of, you know, the idea that in a more world of limited communication systems, there's more mystery, was Cameroon. I mean, sure, they played in the 1982 World Cup, but, you know, I'd certainly never come across Cameroon as a footballing force. I think that went for, you know, 99% of the British public. And that was just a huge and amazing and eye-opening thing. Like, wow. And then, you know, they beat Argentina in the opening game. How good is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was still possible for magic and surprise to happen in a way that subsequently it just doesn't. And people turn up and you know who they are. You know, Senegal turn up and you're not surprised that they put in a performance and that they get a result because you know who they are. So that's great, but it's not novel. It's not thrilling. It's not different. It's not exciting in a way that Cameroon were in 1990. One of the things that connects to what you've just said is that idea of Italian 90 being on a cusp between the old world and the new in football. Is they were tremendously proud of a news information system that they'd built, again, courtesy Olivetti to a great extent,
yeah.
Whereby anybody in the press could get into these press centres, turn on a screen, and get just enormous quantities of information that would never have been available at previous tournaments unless you did your research and carried it around on paper. And... exactly, on paper. Bizarre, isn't it? But they had these systems and you could go in and it was like very, very crude early internet, but you could get a bunch of background data about whoever you didn't know about that you were about to see, which was great, but again, it only worked 50% of the time. And I remember one time hairing into this place and desperately trying to find some information out, and this bloke looking at me and solemnly saying, "The news is broken." Today, the news is never broken, is it?
Sadly. One key element where Italian 90 doesn't seem to have met any modern standard compared to the more recent tournaments is on the take-up of tickets and how they were allocated and marketed and sold. Even USA 94 and soccer, football, is a bit of a mystery back then to a lot of Americans. That seemed to have the sold-out signs up everywhere for the tournament. But yet there were often huge gaps in the stands in Italy, which, you know, bar England and Brazil and places like that, you really would say is a real hotbed of football. What went wrong there, and what lessons were learnt for future World Cups?
The basic problem was that a lot of the ticketing was not directly in the hands of the local organisers in Italy, but had been farmed out and had been chopped up into packages which were very expensive. It wasn't you couldn't just easily get a ticket for a game. You know, if you were coming from another country, it was all about buying the plane tickets, the hotel accommodation, and the match tickets in kind of batches and lumps. And it wasn't at all, it was cumbersome and it was expensive. So in Europe, many, many fans from the different participating countries just made their own arrangements and turned up. And it wasn't always easy then to find a ticket at all. English fans had horrendous difficulties with ludicrous under allocation of tickets for sale of people to people who were just there on the ground. And that was partly about security, but it was partly about an ungainly, unwieldy, and frankly greedy and gouging attempt to price everything up, which didn't come off. And it did look embarrassing at times for some of the less attractive fixtures, where you did have large quantities of empty seats. And I think as a marketing operation, FIFA will have learned from that. It's a huge jump to go from something where they didn't get it right at all to the United States, where the attitude was, we might not know what it is, but we know it's a huge party. We know the world is watching, and we will make it succeed. And we will fill the stadiums, and we will ensure that everyone that wants to get in can get in as far as that is humanly possible, including people who live locally who want this one-time chance to see this thing, whatever it is. And so there was a completely different attitude in the States than there had been from the ticket sales people in Italy.
Do you think it's just...
Who, to be fair, were not necessarily the local World Cup organising committees. I should make that clear, because the people who were directly involved in the organisation of the actual tournament in Italy were fantastic.
Do you think, Pete, there's been a change over the years in public, you know, just punters' attitudes to the World Cup, the sense that, you know, it is this, its status as a spectacle, you know, and the kudos almost that comes from being able to go is much bigger. And, you know, the US already had that culture of attending, you know, the grand commercial spectacle, you know, which is why partly they were able to fill, you know, this absolutely giant stadium, some of them like 100,000. And I just wonder if there was, you know, was that where Italy was at in 1990? Or whether there was a kind of resistance or a sort of disinterest, you know, to seeing other people. Sure, everybody wants to see Italy, but, you know, almost sort of sport as tourism, even for the locals, was something that people just weren't into.
I think that's a very good point. I think there it was still a time when you bought a ticket to see your team. You didn't buy a ticket to be part of an event.
Yeah, exactly.
Today, yeah. If a tournament is on, many of us, be we originally football fans or not, will look at it and go, you know what, I fancy that city and I'll see these three games, and that means that I might not actually see England if I'm English, or I might not see Germany if I'm German, but I will see Croatia and I will see South Korea and I will see Uruguay.
Yeah.
Whereas in 1990... if you were not Uruguayan, you probably didn't buy a ticket to see Uruguay. You know, some did. People went and explored and had great adventures and wonderful times and saw random matches involving teams that were not their team.
There was less of it, though, than there is today. People were more cautious travellers.
Yes. Tournaments were still not fan-friendly, which seems like a ridiculous thing to say today. But if you look at how tournaments now have huge areas set up all around the stadium and in the host cities with like big parks that have huge screens on them, so that taking part in it isn't necessarily about being actually in the stadium.
Yeah.
And that joins in with like fan festivals and music and all sorts going on. In 1990, authorities were still very resistant to that idea, because they thought it meant if someone was in a park watching it on a big screen, they weren't getting any money out of it.
Mm.
They didn't understand the idea of presenting it as a larger cultural festival.
Yeah.
The whole city took part in. There was still this idea of football people as a kind of separate entity who were just there to watch football, and everything else was like, well, do what you want. Good luck.
Yeah.
And
big screens. Do they even have big screens in stadiums then? Had that arrived?
No.
No big screens. Just those sort of like orange.
There was in Milan.
Okay.
Because I remember watching opera in the run up to the game, which obviously is very nice. But in Cagliari, no. Good Lord,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
And again, I don't want any of that to sound critical of the Italians who put the tournament on, because they did do a wonderful job and it was fantastic. But it's just the history of that 30 years ago, the stuff that we take for granted today across the board didn't happen.
Mm.
You know, football was still its own world. And again, this cusp point that we're talking about, the difference between before 1990 and after 1990, football at that time was still in its own world, and it was being being invaded by a bigger world, and it was reaching out to meet a bigger world, and there was like two-way traffic there, and something was going to bloom and expand from that point that in many ways would be great. It would be better for fans. Crucially, it would be safer. Fans would be better understood. There would be more nuance about it. You wouldn't have the whole business of like, you know, literally all English fans are hooligans was like a part and parcel in those days, which was, you know, monstrously unfair, led to absolutely innocent people getting on the wrong end of some pretty brutal beatings here and there because, you know, people didn't understand.
I want to ask you, Pete, about the England fans, because another cusp it occurs to me is looking at the pictures from 1990, the dominant flag is still the Union Jack. There's a few St. George flags, there's a few combos, but definitely the Union Jack is still prominent. And then just 6 years later, by the time we get to Euro 96, and it's England, Germany again, the St. George flag is definitely the predominant flag in the England crowd. And I just wondered, yeah, what you sensed about that sense of, you know, of Englishness and Britishness and the kind of confusions and complications of that. What sort of vibes you were picking up in 1990? Any sense of like where it might be going?
Huh, that's very interesting. I think that's a very tricky and complex area. My suspicion is that people still, English football fans, still sported the Union Jack because they didn't think about it and felt that they owned it. And it was, yeah, it was simple.
Yeah.
And as over time other identities have become more well expressed and more precise and more clear, English nationalists have felt under threat and have retreated to the flag of St. George, I would suggest. But I would also think it's massively more complex than that. But I think there was a kind of ownership of the Union Jack that was resting on a lot of assumptions that English people just took for granted,
yeah,
without any consideration of other nationalities. And unfortunately, that element in the English mindset of just appropriating everything around you and going like, we're the boss, without thinking about it,
yeah,
you know, that's still around 10 times over, 100 times over today, and it's unfortunate, to put it mildly.
What was the kind of mix of the crowd? Because these days, you know, when I've been away to see England, you know, the crowd is, you know, it's mixed. It's not just working class. It's got a kind of very drunken business class end to it. You know, it's got a student university dimension to it. It's got, you know, a sprinkling of like cosmopolitans. Is ethnically a bit more diverse than it used to be. I'm just wondering, what was the mix in 1990?
Like, well, it was certainly not as ethnically diverse as it is today. My sense of it was that it was primarily young lads on a jaunt, in the old traditional sense.
Yeah.
But again, to see that in a sort of cartoon two-dimensional way would be very, very wrong. It's much more mixed than people realise. And as you say, it goes through age ranges, it goes through backgrounds and income brackets, to all kinds of people.
Yeah.
And I think we talk about, you know, the world before and after 1990. One of the things that happened, one of the things that transformed things for football in England, was the success of that tournament. And I remember I was still writing the last chapters of All Played Out when the new season began, and a friend of mine, a Chelsea season ticket holder, rang after the first game and he said, I've just been at the first game, and you know what, there were women there. Now, actually, in and amongst the lads having their fun, yeah, and, you know, the huge majority of them being decent people, having gone to going to Italy to muck in and enjoy themselves, in and amongst them, there were also young women wandering around, enjoying it just the same, but not many. Whereas today, of course, it's much, much more balanced.
Yeah. Well, this probably leads on nicely to sort of the final point we're going to discuss on this area is, and I personally believe that Italia 90 heralded the new age for the World Cup, and I'd probably go a bit bolder here and go as far as to say it was a key event in the birth of modern football altogether. And maybe the fact, you know, the first game of the season following Italia 90, your friend talking about women being there, all comes from the new style TV and media coverage that took place around that tournament. David, you mentioned earlier about the marriage of football with opera at the BBC's opening credits, and we talked in a previous episode to to Philip Burney from the BBC, who was the genius who had that idea of marrying those two together. The coverage, there was more of it. It was done better. Excellent graphics and imagery. And of course, it all coincided with the boom, or the big, let's say, the B of the boom of satellite and digital TV. From an English perspective, there was the soon-to-be-conceived Premier League, which probably, again, surfed on the back of the popularity of Italia 90. The European Cup's revamp to the Champions League was not far in the making, again, probably driven by the success of the coverage of Italia 90, not necessarily the actual football itself. Just the way they transmitted the drama and the stories seemed to be different to what came before it. And of course, we also then had the move into the broadcasting of foreign football, Italian football on Channel 4, not that long after Italia 90. So do you think that's the real modern birth, if you like, that came in Italia 90, if we look at everything in the round?
For me, I've got no doubt Italia 90 was an absolutely pivotal tournament. Absolutely pivotal for English football specifically, very much so. A huge rebirth, not just on the pitch but off it, and a massive uplifting, a massive encouragement, a really good thing, and many, many good things flowed from it for the English. But I think for the game as a whole in the world, there's this really interesting contrast where some people say that in terms of the game on the pitch, Italia 90 had some dreadful football. Well, that disregards the fact that it also had some incredibly dramatic football, and the fact that there were very few goals scored doesn't mean that the football was bad. But people looked at the drama and the stories involved in that in those 4 weeks, and it sort of spread excitement and enthusiasm and an uplift. I mean, you know, remember the 80s were pretty grotty times for football in a lot of ways, again, particularly for England, with some terrible, terrible events blighting the game and society beyond the game. But for literally everyone, I think Italia 90 just made people look forward. You know, what can we do? How much more can we make of this? And I mean this in the most positive senses. I realised that the marketing guys were sitting there rubbing their hands together and thinking we can make billions here. And sure enough, they did and they do. But disregard that. You know, in terms of like making the game a huge cultural positive, there was just a huge boost given to that notion by Italia 90. It was just such a colourful, it was beautiful. It was beautiful, beautiful 4 weeks.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate and say all of that is true, and Italia 90 kind of sets the stage or kind of illuminates things that have come. But when satellite television arrives, you know, and it goes digital, and that's still a couple of years away, that is the most sort of, I think, profound and decisive moment in transforming modern football. You know, the globalization of everything that has followed, from, you know, fans' affections to player markets to the sheer scale of the industry, and with it the way it now attracts, you know, politicians and power and coverage as never before, is just ahead of Italia 90. The dam is about to break, but it's not quite there yet.
But does one not happen without the other? Maybe I'm being a bit too specific here when we're looking at England and, you know, all the Paul Gascoigne crying and the run to the semi-finals and everything. Do you think that if we look at the Premier League, which kind of was conceived around about late 1990, early 1991 for its launch in 92, had the chairman of the, first of all, the Big Five at the time, not seen, oh, hang on a second, look what's possible with a bit of an imagination put into the television production, what's possible with this game that we had for the late 1980s, where they couldn't give it away to the TV companies almost, and then there was that success in how the tournament was broadcast. Would the Premier League and subsequently the Champions League rebrand not have occurred, or certainly not has been successfully launched and rebranded, had Italia 90 not been transmitted around the world with such success?
I think those things were all coming anyway. I mean, I think Italia 90 confirmed that. I mean, UEFA have been working on the transformation of the champion, you know, into the Champions League for some time. And sure, it will have encouraged and supported those trends of development. But I think they were coming anyway. You know, the big, you know, discussions about breakaway leagues had been, you know, had happened. And Berlusconi has arrived. You know, the man who really brings the whole notion of, you know, the commercial televised spectacle. I think we can overestimate it as, you know, coming from England. You know, our story is more decisively shifted probably by the Italia 90 than others. But I don't think that's the same for everybody. You know, the world is moving at a different, you know, not everyone's moving at the same pace.
I think David's absolutely spot on there. I think there are three factors, and I think the key one that David identifies, of course, is the money, and the money comes from television, and that's the big driver ultimately. But the other factors, I think, are Italia 90 as a sort of seedbed for so much, and then for England, most important of all, I hate to have to say this, but Hillsborough. And subsequently, the Taylor Report. We can talk about all the positives in Italia 90, and we can talk about the money and the television being the big driver, but unfortunately, the pivotal moment isn't in the San Siro or Cagliari or Turin. The pivotal moment, as far as English football, had already happened in Sheffield, and it was a straightforward thing. You have to look at that and say, this, we cannot go on. We cannot go on as we are. You know, that is so unacceptable, so awful, so abject how authorities have allowed the game to come to that point. We've got to change. So yes, you know, Italia 90 is a wonderful, wonderful thing for someone as fortunate as me who was at it to look back on. But in terms of changing the English game, yeah, you know, Italia 90 was a rebirth for English football. But the bigger picture, Hillsborough.
Yeah, I think Pete's right about that. And what's really interesting to note about those years is the bottom of the lowest attendance at English football is in 1986, 85, I should say, which itself is a bad year. You know, the tragedy of the Bradford Fire, Heysel, Millwall Luton, FA Cup sixth round riot, televised, you know, live on television. And extraordinarily, attendances start rising immediately afterwards. And in fact, the year after Hillsborough, you know, where you might think, my God, you know, that's going to put people off coming to football, actually attendances continue to rise. And there's sort of something, you know, deep, kind of, I think, quite sort of deep stirring in English society that is bringing people back to football in that era. And in the absence of Hillsborough, I don't think that would have turned into the kind of completely transformed new world of the 1990s. You know, until the public order issue and the policing issues and the infrastructure issues, you know, had been finally addressed. You know, you couldn't have the Premier League, you couldn't have anything that comes afterwards. And Hillsborough is absolutely, you know, and tragically the catalyst for that. But there's something, yeah. Also, you know, despite Hillsborough, there is also an Italia 90, which are part of, you know, this moment. You know, I think in the mid-1980s, people start wanting to go back to football. You know, I don't think it's sort of unconnected to the fact that there's a sense of the old really has passed. The miner strike has happened. Old industrial England is not coming back. Whatever it's going to be, it ain't going to be that again. And something's been lost in the process. Where do you go and kind of find something of that? I kind of think that's something like that is stirring in the English body politic in the mid-1980s as well.
Well, I think I think we've not been able to absolutely nail down that Italia 90 was the first modern World Cup, but I think we can all probably agree that it was the moment where things began to change, and I think it's certainly a key point in the development of football. Trivia time leads us to the UAE and their head coach, Carlos Alberto Pereira, who has an immense World Cup pedigree. He jointly holds the record for leading five different nations to the World Cup finals with Bora Milutinovic, who coincidentally was also at Italia 90 managing Costa Rica. Pereira managed Kuwait in 1982, the UAE in 1990, Brazil in 1994, Saudi Arabia in 1998, and South Africa in 2010. He guided his own country, Brazil, to victory in 1994, but even that might not count amongst his most notable World Cup experiences. In 2010, after South Africa beat France, the French coach Raymond Domenech refused to shake hands with him. In 1998, Pereira was fired by the Saudis after just two group games. And in 1982, his Kuwait side were involved in one of the World Cup's most bizarre events when they took on France in the group stages. Late in the second half and trailing 3-1, his players thought they'd heard a whistle to signal an offside decision. They all stopped, allowing the French to score a fourth goal. The referee indicated that he hadn't blown his whistle at all and that it may have been a noise from the crowd. Kuwaiti prince and head of their FA, Sheikh Fahad Al-Ahmad Al-Jaba Al-Sabah, sat in the stands, made his way onto the field and waved for the Kuwaiti players to leave the field in protest at the perceived injustice. The game was held up for around 10 minutes while the farce unfolded. Incredibly, the referee bowed to the pressure and disallowed the goal amid chaotic scenes. France still went on to win 4-1 anyway. Sadly, Sheikh Fahad was killed less than a month after the end of Italia 90, whilst fighting alongside the army defending Kuwait during the invasion by Iraqi forces. So, that's your lot for today, I'm afraid, but fear not, we are back tomorrow. But first, I'd like to thank today's brilliant guests. David Goldblatt, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, been a pleasure.
And if anybody wants to follow you on Twitter, David, where can they do that?
At David S. Goldblatt.
And Pete, a pleasure as always. Remind everybody what your Twitter is, please.
Thank you, Mark. I've enjoyed it very much on Twitter. I am at PeteDavis2006.
Brilliant. And for my previous guest, Ali Khaled, he is at AliKhaled_.
We are at VinciRR90 on Twitter and Instagram, and this podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. So don't forget to join us again tomorrow as Scotland look for redemption, Costa Rica try to conjure up another shock, and England face Holland in Group F, looking to get their world in motion. Goodbye.